I want you to close your eyes for a second and picture a crowded room.
Okay.
Maybe it's a holiday party where you don't really know anyone, or maybe you're just jammed into a train station at rush hour.
Yeah.
It is shoulder to shoulder, hot, and uncomfortable.
I'm with you.
Now, here's the question. If you're trying to get out of that room, does the crowd slow you down?
I mean, you'd think so.
Or does the fact that you desperately want to get away from all those elbows and invaded personal spaces
Yeah.
actually make you move faster toward the exit?
That is a very philosophical, almost psychological way to open a discussion on metallurgy. I didn't realize we were doing a deep dive into social anxiety today.
I try my best to keep things relatable, but it is relevant,
Too
right?
bad, yeah.
Because today we are looking at a paper that deals with exactly this problem, but, at the atomic level.
Right.
We're deep diving into a classic piece of scientific detective work from 1981 by HKDH Padatia.
Yes, from the University of Cambridge, specifically the Department of Metallurgy and Materials Science. And while the date says 1981, the methodology here is, well, it's timeless.
The title of the paper is Diffusion of Carbon in Austenite. Now, I'll admit, when I first saw that title, I thought, okay, this is going to be dry.
It sounds it.
I mean, it sounds like something you'd gloss over in a textbook index.
Yeah.
But when you actually read it, it's a story about what scientists do when they literally run out of data.
That is the perfect way to frame it. The mission of this deep dive isn't just to learn about carbon atoms wiggling around.
Oh.
It's to understand how we can predict the future, or specifically predict how steel behaves when we're flying blind. It's about bridging a gap in human knowledge using pure physics,
Yeah.
because the experiments just couldn't take us far enough.
So let's set the stage a bit before we get into the heavy math. Why are we so obsessed with carbon moving through austenite? I mean, steel is hard, it's solid. I don't usually think of things moving inside a solid block of metal.
That's the common misconception. We think of metal as static, but steel is incredibly dynamic, especially when it's hot. To make high-quality steel, you often have to heat it up until it becomes austenite.
And for those of us who maybe skipped Material Science 101, what is austenite exactly?
It's a specific crystal structure of iron. Imagine the iron atoms arranging themselves in a specific pattern that leaves little gaps or holes in the structure. Austenite is like a sponge for carbon. It can dissolve a lot of carbon into those little gaps.
Okay, so austenite is the sponge. Got it.
But here's the catch. You don't keep it as austenite. To get the steel properties you want, like hardness or flexibility, you cool it down to transform it into other phases, like ferrite.
Ah, okay.
And that transformation is what we call diffusion controlled.
Which means the speed of the change depends on how fast the carbon atoms can get out of the way.
Precisely. Think of it like a construction project. If you want to grow a ferrite plate, think of it as a structural beam forming inside the microscopic grain of the steel. That plate can only grow as fast as the carbon atoms can diffuse away from the interface.
With the traffic problem.
It is exactly a traffic problem. To model how steel hardens or how fast a ferrite plate grows, you need to know the diffusivity of carbon. You need to know the speed limit of those atoms wiggling through the crystal
And if
lattice.
you get that speed wrong.
Your entire prediction for the steel strength is wrong.
Okay, so we need a speedometer for carbon atoms. Seems straightforward enough. Where does the detective story come in? Why was this a problem in 1981?
The detective story starts with a blind spot. The paper points out a massive complication that ruins the simplicity of just measuring the speed. The speed
Yeah.
limit of carbon isn't constant, it is concentration dependent.
Going back to my room analogy. My walking speed changes depending on how many people are in the room. If it's empty, I can sprint. If it's packed, I'm shuffling.
Right. And in 1981, this was a huge headache. Scientists had plenty of experimental data for low concentrations of carbon. They had measured the diffusivity, which we call D for carbon mole fractions, up to about 0.06.
0.06. That sounds tiny. Is that even enough to matter?
It is fairly low. In terms of weight percentage, it's significant enough for some steels, but it's not the whole picture. The problem is that the real heavy lifting in steel manufacturing, the transformations that create the strongest, most useful microstructures, often happens at much higher carbon concentrations.
So the interesting stuff, the high-performance stuff, happens beyond 0.06.
Exactly. The text mentions that at the interface where the steel is transforming, the carbon concentration can be much, much higher. So scientists were in a bind. They had a map for the first mile of the journey, but the destination was 10 miles away in uncharted
And
territory.
you can't just guess,
Or
can you? The paper mentions some people did try to guess.
they did. I mean, you have to work with what you have. Before Badacia wrote this paper, there was a group led by Kaufman. They tried to bridge this gap with what we might call an empirical workaround.
Empirical workaround sounds like polite scientists speak for they fudged it.
Not quite fudged, but they looked for patterns where they could find them. They assumed there was a link between the activation energy required to grow the steel structure and the activation energy required for carbon to move.
So they thought, hey, these two energy numbers seem related. Let's assume they stay related forever.
Basically, they also assumed that a certain part of the math, the pre-exponential factor, would just continue in a straight line if they extrapolated it.
So they just took a ruler and extended the line on the graph.
That's a good way to put it. And to be fair, sometimes that works. It was a clever guess. It wasn't baseless. But Badacia points out that this relies on critical assumptions. And in the world of physics, an assumption is a weak link. If that relationship doesn't actually hold up at high concentrations, if the physics changes when the room gets crowded, your entire model for designing steel collapses.
So Badacia decides to ditch the ruler and go back to first principles. He wants a model that doesn't need to guess. He wants to know why the carbon is moving.
Exactly. He turns to a theoretical model created by Siller and McClellan. The paper describes it as elegant.
I always get nervous when physicists call math elegant. It usually means incredibly difficult to solve or bizarrely abstract.
In this case, elegant means it's robust. It respects both kinetics, how things move, and thermodynamics, how things settle into equilibrium. It doesn't need arbitrary constants or, you know, fudge factors. It describes the reality of the atom.
Okay, let's pop the hood on this Siller-McClellan model. What makes it different from just drawing a line? How does it actually calculate the speed?
Well, it looks at why the carbon moves. It breaks diffusion down into two main drivers. First, there's the activity of the carbon. This is related to the chemical potential gradient.
Which is the standard stuff, right?
Yeah.
Atoms naturally want to flow from high concentration to low concentration, like water flowing downhill.
Right. If you have a pile of carbon atoms on the left and none on the right, they will naturally spread out. That's the easy part. Mm. But the second factor is the game changer, and it brings us right back to your hook about the crowded room.
This is the part I really wanted to get to.
The model explicitly accounts for repulsive interactions between neighboring carbon atoms.
Repulsion. So the carbon atoms actually push each other away.
They do. You have to visualize where these atoms are. In austenite, the carbon atoms sit in what are called octahedral interstitial sites.
Okay, break that down for us non-metallurgists. Octahedral interstitial sites.
Imagine the iron atoms are stacked up like cannonballs or oranges in a crate. They're big atoms. Between them, there are tiny little gaps or pockets. Those are the interstitial sites.
Okay.
Carbon is a small atom compared to iron, so it squeezes into those gaps.
It's squeezing into the empty seats in the theater.
Yes, but it's a tight squeeze. Siller and McClellan realized that if a carbon atom is sitting in one of those gaps, it distorts the iron lattice around it. It stretches the metal slightly. This makes it very, very uncomfortable for another carbon atom to try and sit in the gap right next to it.
Nobody wants a neighbor. It's like on a bus. You don't sit next to someone unless you absolutely have to.
Exactly. They repel each other. Now, intuitively, if I told you these atoms repel each other, you might think this would slow everything down.
Yeah, of course.
If everyone is pushing everyone else, it sounds like gridlock, right? Like friction.
Yeah, exactly. I'd assume they get stuck.
But here's the paradox. The paper explains that this repulsion actually enhances diffusion. It makes the atoms move faster down the concentration gradient.
Wait, the get away from me force makes them speed up? How does that work?
Think about the gradient. We're trying to calculate how fast carbon moves from a high concentration area to a low concentration area. So imagine you're a carbon atom sitting on the border. Behind you is the high concentration area. It is crowded. There are carbon atoms in all the seats nearby. They're all pushing on the lattice, creating this repulsion field.
So you're feeling a massive shove from behind.
A massive shove. You want out. Now look ahead. Toward the low concentration area, there are fewer atoms there. That means there are fewer atoms pushing back at you.
So the push from behind is stronger than the push from the front?
Significantly stronger. The text says a carbon atom attempting random motion sees an exaggerated difference in the available sites. The probability of moving forward into the empty space skyrockets because you are literally being shoved out of the crowded zone by your neighbors.
That is fascinating. So the fact that they hate being near each other acts like a spring, launching them out of the high concentration zone.
That's a perfect analogy. The repulsion creates a thermodynamic driving force, and Badacia isn't just waving his hands here. The paper assigns a very specific energy value to this. The repulsive interaction energy is 8,250 joules per mole.
8,250? That's a very precise number.
It is. And having that specific number allows him to plug it into the math to see if it actually predicts reality.
Well, let's talk about that proof.
Yeah.
Because it's one thing to have a cool theory about antisocial atoms launching each other around. It's another to prove it matches the steel hardening in a factory. How did he validate this?
He used a really clever technique involving reverse engineering. The paper introduces equation 2. I won't read the whole formula because it's heavy on the Greek letters, but it essentially says diffusion, which is D, equals a constant. D prime multiplied by a complex term, xi of theta.
So D equals D prime times A, crowding factor.
Roughly, yes. The crowding factor accounts for all that repulsion and activity we just talked about. But here's the key. The term D prime, that initial constant, should theoretically be independent of concentration.
It shouldn't change.
It should only depend on temperature.
Okay. So if the theory is right, D prime is the speed limit on an empty road. It shouldn't change just because traffic gets heavier. The crowding factor handles the traffic part.
Exactly. So Padacia took the existing experimental data, remember the stuff, up to 0.06 mole fraction that everyone already had.
Right. The stuff they knew was solid.
And he worked backward. He said, I know the total speed, D, from the experiments, and I know the concentration. Let me plug those in and calculate what D prime must be.
And if his model is wrong?
If the model is wrong, if that crowding factor math is incorrect, then the calculated D prime would be all over the place. It would wiggle around as the concentration changed. It wouldn't be constant.
And what did he find?
We have to look at figure 1 in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
He plotted the calculated ranges of D prime for various carbon contents. And for any given temperature, the values are incredibly tight. The text describes them as vertical bars representing the range, and they are short, very short.
So D prime stayed flat.
It stayed flat. This confirms that the Siller and McClellan model successfully stripped away the concentration effects. It proves that the repulsion math was accurate. It effectively cleaned the data.
That's the first win. But he went further, didn't he? I'm looking at figure 2, which mentions regression analysis.
Right. So once he knew D prime was a valid constant for a given temperature, he needed to find the fundamental physical properties hidden inside it. He plotted the average D prime values against temperature.
And for our listeners visualizing this, what did that graph look like?
It showed excellent linearity.
Which, as scientists speak for, the dots formed a perfect straight line.
Yes. And that straight line is the gold standard. It means the relationship follows the Arrhenius law basic thermodynamics.
Because the line was so perfect.
He could extract the slope and the intercept to get the fundamental constants of the universe, essentially, for this system.
We have those numbers here in the notes.
Yeah.
The slope gave him an activation energy term, something like 21,230.
Delta F star over K equals 21,230 Kelvin inverse. And the intercept gave him a value of 31.84.
To a layperson, those are just random numbers. But for a material scientist, having those constants is like cracking the code, isn't it?
It is exactly like cracking the code. It means you no longer need to measure anything. You have the source code of the atom's behavior.
Wow.
Once he had those constants, he could rebuild the entire diffusion curve from scratch.
And that's what figure 3 is, right? The victory lap.
It is. He took his new equation, plugged in his new constants, and predicted the diffusion rates. When plotted against the original experimental data, they fell almost perfectly on the line of slope 1.
So the model perfectly explains the past. It fits the known data.
Which earns it the right to predict the future. And this brings us to the mapping the unknown section of the paper. This is where Padacia finally solves the problem we started with.
The blind spot. The high carbon concentrations where no data existed.
Exactly. He uses the validated model to calculate the diffusivity for carbon contents way beyond the 0.06 limit. He generates the map for the territory nobody had ever visited.
And what did that map look like? In figure 4, they compare his new physics-based curves to the old Kaufman guessing method. I'm curious, was the old guess just completely wrong?
Surprisingly, no. The text notes that the agreement between the two methods is not bad. the dashed straight lines, which represent the old Kaufman guess, and the bold curves, Padecia's physics, are actually reasonably close.
That feels a bit anticlimactic. If the guess was close, why go through all this trouble with interstitial sites and repulsion energy? Why do the math, if the ruling worked?
That is the million-dollar question in science. The guess was close by luck, or rather by intuitive extrapolation. But it was fragile. It was based on assumptions that might not hold up if you change the conditions.
It's the difference between memorizing the answer to a test question and actually knowing how to solve the problem.
Exactly. If you change the alloy slightly or move to a different temperature range, the Kaufman guess might fall apart completely because it wasn't based on why the atoms move. Benetti's model is built on the fundamental truth of the atoms.
So the paper concludes that the Siller and McClellan method is more desirable.
Yes. Not because the numbers are wildly different in the specific instance, but because it avoids critical assumptions. It's robust. It's knowledge versus estimation.
So, thanks to this paper, we can now design steels with high carbon phases and know exactly how they will transform because we understand the push and pull of the atoms themselves.
We understand that 8,250 joules of repulsion, and that allows for precision engineering in everything from car chassis to skyscrapers. When you're building something that millions of people rely on, you don't want to rely on a guess. You want the physics.
It's a great reminder that sometimes to go forward, you have to go deep. You have to understand the microscopic interactions.
And you have to trust the physics when the data runs out. That's really the core message here. When the map ends, you navigate by the stars, or in this case, by the laws of thermodynamics.
I want to circle back to that repulsion idea one last time before we wrap up. It's really stuck with me.
The idea that negative forces drive speed.
Yeah. We usually think of attraction or cooperation as the things that make systems flow efficiently. We think if we all get along, we'll move faster. But in this case, it was get away from me that acted as the accelerator.
Right.
The carbon atoms moved faster because they were trying to escape their neighbors.
It creates a powerful instability. If everyone is comfortable where they are, nobody moves. The repulsion creates the pressure gradient that drives the flux.
It makes you wonder. We see this in atoms. But where else in complex systems does this apply? Maybe in traffic engineering? Does wanting to get away from other cars improve flow? Or in economics?
Or even biological evolution. Sometimes not wanting to be here gets you to the destination faster than wanting to be there. A repulsive force can be just as constructive as an attractive one if it's pointed in the right direction.
That is a thought to chew on. When does a repulsion serve as an accelerator rather than a brake? We'll leave you with that to think about. Thanks for listening to this deep dive into the atomic dance of steel.
Thanks, everyone.
See you in the next one.